out of here. Call a crane service, pull a chitty-chitty-bang-bang. Laura rolled her seat forward as far as it would go and sat extremely erect, white-knuckled, her elbows gripping the wheel like it was the helm of a ship that was about to get carried out to sea. She set out across the lawn. So as not to frighten the residents of this house, or come across as a fugitive or a drunk, she wore a friendly smile and drove very slowly, prepared to stop at any moment and explain herself. If anyone was home, they stayed inside, and if the police were called, Laura successfully vacated the premises before they arrived. The house's driveway was wide and newly paved, and it delivered them back to the road they'd been on. Giddy with adrenaline, Laura made a right, and shortly after doing so, Nicholas spotted the correct turn. "Well, that was an adventure," Laura said, pulling up to the facility's main entrance. She felt victorious, the hero of the day. Now that the ordeal was behind them, it was a funny story she couldn't wait to tell. Laura waited in the car as Nicholas went inside to collect Stephanie and the baby. She wanted the car to be cool for them, so she kept the ignition on and the AC running, though it made her wince. When 15 minutes passed, she turned the car off and opened all the windows. After another 15 minutes, Nicholas came back out on his own.
"Stephanie is not in a great place right now," he said, leaning in the passenger side window. "It was decided she and the baby are going to spend a little more time here."
Laura was confused. "They're not letting her come home today?"
Nicholas shook his head. "I spoke to her this morning, and she sounded great. I told her I'd be here by 1, and apparently when we were late, she thought I wasn't coming, and she got quite worked up."
"Did you explain what happened? How you didn't know where we were going and we got lost?" Nicholas looked annoyed by the question.
"Of course I did. But the point is, she didn't know that at the time. She felt abandoned, and she got quite worked up. And as I said, she's not in a great place right now."
"Oh, dear," Laura bit her lip. "I'm so sorry, Nick. I feel responsible." Laura knew she was not responsible for what happened. Any rational person could see this. She waited for him to reject her apology as unfounded, to thank her for taking the day off from work to drive up here, to commend her courage and competence in getting them out of the woods, and, in doing so, acknowledge that the detour had been his own fault, as he should have come prepared with directions from the highway. But Nicholas expressed none of the above. Instead, he reached into his back pocket and took out his wallet. "What's this for?" Laura asked as he passed her 250s.
"Gas money," he said. "I'm going to stick around for the afternoon. I'll take the train home. You should get back to Emma."
"She's having a playdate with Charlotte. Margaret's got her for the day."
"Well, I'm sure you have things to do," Nicholas said.
Jaw clenched, he put his hands in his pocket. "Nick," Laura said, feeling her mouth go dry, "this isn't my fault. You can't be mad at me."
"I appreciate your taking the day off from work and trying to help," were his parting words.
But he didn't appreciate it. He thought this was her fault, and he was mad at her. Even before they'd gotten lost, his demeanor had been far from gracious. Laura had never experienced road rage, but it didn't seem like a good idea to drive this angry. She sat in the parking lot, ignition running, AC blasting, trying to calm down. She tried to put things in perspective by thinking about today's record-high temperature and how the Earth was doomed. Normally, the sobering reality of the trajectory they were on eclipsed whatever trivial thought or anxiety she'd been grappling with, or at least dulled its edge. But today, it had the opposite effect. There were steps leading to the building's entrance. A righteous momentum carried her up these 2 at a time. Then a pair of magnetically operated glass doors swooshed open in cowering deference to her clipped advance.
"I can't let you in if your name isn't on our visitors list," the receptionist coolly informed her.
"Understood," Laura said, "but as I just explained, I'm not here as a visitor. I'm the driver of a visitor. My brother is visiting his wife and their baby, my nephew. I need to speak with him." The exchange caught the attention of a passing doctor who said he would get Nicholas and invited Laura to take a seat in the waiting area. Enough time passed so that her outrage subsided,
and she began to feel silly. But then Nicholas appeared, looking confused and a little cranky to see her, and it riled back to life. As Laura stood up, the seat of her chair made a flatulent squeaking sound. Her skirt was still damp from sitting in the clammy heat of the car, and now it clung to her thighs like cellophane. She peeled it off, but it immediately reestablished contact.
"I feel like you hate me," were the first words that came tumbling out, "and I don't know why."
Nicholas looked more weary and annoyed than concerned or defensive.
"I don't hate you, Laura," he said, his eyes half shut.
"Then why do you treat me with such contempt?"
Lids fluttering half-mast.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"This," Laura's voice quivered, "what you're doing right now, closing your eyes when I talk to you, making me feel small and ridiculous, like I'm some irrational, emotional woman."
Nicholas sighed, looked down, and cupped the back of his neck.
"I'm not sure what's going on or what you want from me right now, but whatever it is, it's going to have to wait."
Standing up straight, he crossed his arms and looked her in the eye.
"Visiting hours are over soon, and I would like to see my family."
"Your family?"
Laura's voice rose and cracked over the word, which came out in a regrettable high pitch.
"You say that like I'm...
Nicholas appeared to exchange a look with someone over her shoulder, and Laura turned and saw that they had a small audience, staff judging from their clinical stares and white coats.
"Go be with your family," she said curtly, and walked out to her car.
As she drove home, Laura's anger cooled. By the time she reached the Henry Hudson toll booth, she was deeply ashamed. All these people watching her erupt like that, and now Nicholas had to deal with the embarrassment of it too, as if he didn't already have enough on his plate. She called him as soon as she got back to the apartment, and left a message on his answering machine to apologize, and let him know that there was no need to continue their discussion. In fact, she'd love it if they never spoke of the episode again.
"I don't know what came over me," she reiterated, before hanging up. "It must have been the heat."
Emma wasn't the only one with the stomach flu. Dr. Brown's waiting room was full.
"Allie Hutchinson," the receptionist called. "Dr. Brown is ready to see you."
"Our appointment is with Dr. Wendell," Allie's mother spoke up.
"Yes," the receptionist said, "but he's running behind, so Dr. Brown is taking some of his patients."
"We will wait to see our doctor," Allie's mother said briskly, and disappeared behind a copy of The New Yorker.
The receptionist read the next name on the list.
"Thomas DuPont?"
"Is this for Dr. Wendell?" the boy's mother asked. "If not, we'll wait as well."
Laura was baffled by Dr. Wendell's sudden popularity. In the beginning, Dr. Brown had been the more sought after of the two partners, but recently things had reversed. It made no sense. Dr. Brown was everything anyone could hope for in a pediatrician, while Dr. Wendell, old and gruff to begin with, was only getting older and gruffer. It was amazing more children weren't scared of him. When she was very young, Emma had once asked Laura if he was Mr. McGregor, the evil farmer who tried to kill Peter Rabbit. That was the kind of energy he projected. Laura wondered what Dr. Brown made of his overnight demotion to second fiddle of Carnegie Hill Pediatrics. She hoped it hadn't hurt his self-esteem. He was a wonderful doctor, competent, wise, patient, and compassionate. She wanted to convey these sentiments to Dr. Brown, but couldn't imagine doing it in person. He was too modest and would start to laugh or tell her to stop. She would have to write them in a letter. But when and how would she give him the letter? One day Emma would be too old to see a pediatrician. Perhaps that would be the appropriate occasion. Thinking of that day, their final appointment with Dr. Brown, Laura's throat swelled and she had to blink back tears.
"You know what the best part of diarrhea is?" Emma greeted Dr. Brown as he entered the examination room.
"Getting to see Dr. Brown," Laura answered.
"No," Emma shook her head. "You're allowed to drink Coke."
I would switch to ginger ale, Dr. Brown told Laura in a no-nonsense tone. Putting on a pair of rubber gloves, he added, caffeine is never great, especially when a child is dehydrated.
Laura nodded. Dr. Brown must have been having a bad day. His curt tone was out of character.
Everyone was allowed to have bad moods, she told herself.
Unlike actors in films whose performances at least tried to feel true to life, stage actors seemed determined to remind you that they were in show business. Between their affected gestures, exaggerated facial expressions, and hammy delivery of their lines, Laura found it difficult to believe whatever story it was they were trying to tell. Not to mention that plays invariably contained at least one major implausible revelation about a family secret, or some such, after which the cast fell silent and the audience was supposed to gasp with shock. However, like church, it was something she knew it was important to do every so often, and when Margaret called to say she had 2 tickets to Miss Bennett that night, Laura pretended she'd heard of the show and said she'd love to go.
I'm not exactly looking forward to it, Margaret confessed before getting off the phone, but as the secretary of the Alumni Association, I feel I ought to see what all the fuss is about.
And then Laura realized she had heard of Miss Bennett, an off-Broadway musical about Winthrop, written by a girl who'd been in the class below theirs. It was a satire, and according to the New York Times critic, a scabrous gender-bending send-up of female prep school culture. The gender-bending part was that it featured an all-male cast. Margaret believed in dressing up for the theater, and Laura felt obligated to change out of her turtleneck skirt and cowboy boots. She was on her way out the door, pumps, blouse, blue satin skirt, when she remembered this wasn't Lincoln Center they were going to. The theater was on Broome Street. The turtleneck skirt and cowboy boots went back on. Her instincts were right. Laura felt a smug sense of victory upon arriving at the theater in her uniform, where she fit right in among a downtown crowd of blue jeans and leather jackets. For once in their lives, it was Margaret, in her pearls and pink tweed skirt and blazer, who looked out of place. They sat in the front row. The actors were dressed in the school uniform as it had been in the 60s, which, in addition to the tunic, included hats and blazers. Laura had mixed feelings about her alma mater, but watching it ridiculed in a small black box theater stirred up tender affection for the institution. The second scene depicted prayers. As the cast recited Bible verses, they got really into their roles, and their enunciation of certain words released a spray of saliva, the heavier, dewier fragments of which occasionally made contact with Laura's face. Margaret, who'd always been deathly terrified of germs, slunk back in her seat, but this did little to protect her from the mist, and after a minute of looking very uncomfortable and unhappy, and taking deep, nervous breaths, she incrementally leaned forward until she was no longer on her seat, but on all fours and crawling down the narrow space between the stage and the knees of everyone in the front row. After reaching the end of the row, she stood up and disappeared through the swinging doors that led to the cocktail lounge. Laura waited until intermission to join her.
"I didn't feel safe with all that spitting," she whispered, pulling Laura into the ladies' room.
After fishing around in her purse, she held up a little bottle of Listerine.
"Here, drink this," she said, handing it to Laura.
Laura took a swig and spat it out in the sink.
"No, you need to drink it," she said. "One capful, don't spit it out."
"You're not supposed to swallow Listerine," Laura protested.
"It's nothing," Margaret said dismissively. "It's like taking a shot of vodka." "Do it," she said, when Laura hesitated to take the bottle back from her.
"Please, Laura, don't be stubborn. I took you here tonight, and I couldn't live with myself if
you caught."
Laura laughed. "If I caught a cold?"
"I'm not talking about a cold, Laura," she whispered sternly. "I'm talking about..."
She looked around the ladies' room to make sure no one was listening and whispered the letters AIDS. They did not return to their seats for the second half of the show.
Margaret buckled her seatbelt in the taxi home and shook her head. I don't know what I was thinking getting front row seats. We're already so vulnerable living in New York City, the homosexual capital of the world. So much is already out of our control. God forbid you get hit by a bus and need a blood transfusion.
What made you think any of them were homosexual? Laura asked.
Oh, Laura, she said. Most theater actors are, and these ones certainly were.
They were?
You really are slow to pick up on things, Margaret said, looking at her fondly. It's kind of sweet.
Within seconds, however, Margaret's face turned serious.
I've been meaning to talk to you about your pediatrician, she said.
It was their fourth day in Ashant, and they'd yet to see the sun. The rain had been intermittent, but today it was steady. According to the thermometer, it was 62, though the damp draft made it feel much colder. Laura tried to light a fire, but ran out of newspaper before it got going. Poking around the attic, she found a copy of the New York Times. She was about to take it before she saw it was from August 10, 1974. And the front page announced Nixon's resignation. She couldn't bear to burn that. Instead, she used a 1964 edition of the Summer Social Register.
You're burning a book, Emma said, sounding vaguely impressed. Isn't that bad?
Normally, yes, Laura acknowledged, ripping out another page. But this is an idiotic book. She got on her knees and stuffed the balled-up paper beneath the logs. Palms on the floor, she leaned in close and blew until the flame caught. Emma laughed.
Mom, you're sticking your butt in the air.
The weather became more volatile as the afternoon progressed, with thunder and sudden gusts of wind that shrieked like a tea kettle. They ate an early dinner of leftover lasagna. After doing the dishes, Laura went back to the living room, revived the fire with a fresh log and returned to her book. She'd read Anna Karenina in high school and then again in her 20s, but it was just as engrossing a third time. Laura didn't even notice it had stopped raining until Emma came scampering downstairs.
Gotta go save the worms before they get run over, she announced.
The front door was swollen with moisture, making it difficult to open. As Laura wrestled with it, Emma lost patience, opened a window, jostled the screen loose, and climbed through.
Wait, Laura called, crawling out after her.
The front had passed, leaving the sky in fluorescent shambles. The light was shrill and cast everything in bewitchingly crisp resolution. A beautiful bruised sunset was in the works. The lawn was like a soggy sponge beneath their bare feet, and by the time they reached the road, their toes were threaded with loose strands of grass. There was only one worm on the stretch of road in front of their house, and after Emma relocated it to a bank of moss beside the driveway, Laura suggested they take a walk to look for more. On their way up the point, they crossed paths with Uncle Frank and Aunt Alice, their perky gaggle of corgis faithfully trundling behind them. As was their custom to do in the evening, the couple was dressed up, Alice in pearls and pink lipstick, Uncle Frank in his faded red pants and brass-buttoned jacket. What was left of his hair wasn't much, but he'd parted it to the side and matted it down. Laura admired Alice and Frank, but not for the reasons everyone else did. Among their extended family, Alice and Frank's childlessness was alluded to as a tragic circumstance, their upbeat, cheerful demeanor hailed as brave. Laura found this patronizing because Alice and Frank struck her as genuinely happy, the rare husband and wife who truly enjoyed each other's company.
Certainly more so than any other couple she could think of.
We were just talking about the new millennium, Alice said with a mischievous smile. We're in the 80s now, soon it'll be the 90s, and I asked Frank, what will we call the decade after that? And Frank said...
And I said, Frank cut in, we won't call it anything, dear. We'll be up there.
He wagged a finger at the sky, and the two laughed merrily.
Didn't you call it the aughts? Laura asked, realizing they would have been children in the first decade of the 1900s.
Yes, Alice nodded. I think that's right.
I ought to agree, Frank said,
and Alice made a raspberry sound of playful disapproval. A butterfly came along and landed on a nearby stone wall. Emma slowly approached to admire it. Alice and Frank continued on their way. As Laura turned to watch them go, a frisky breeze snaked out of the bushes and inflated the skirt of Alice's dress like an umbrella. At the same time, it gently lifted Uncle Frank's comb-over, revealing the primitive contours of his skull, which was the delicate pink of the inside of a conch shell. If either of them noticed, they didn't seem to care. Unfazed, arm in arm, on they strode, each step just barely grazing the cusp of their shadows, which, being longer and more limber, loped valiantly ahead into the evening. It was completely irrational. There was no reason to believe Dr. Brown had AIDS. Furthermore, in the event he did have the virus, the possibility of his infecting Emma involved ridiculous scenarios of a highly unlikely nature. Still, this didn't stop Laura from conjuring them in the middle of the night. Margaret had succeeded in planting a seed of anxiety, and Laura couldn't deny that her immediate reaction was relief when, in August of that summer, a letter was forwarded to her at Ushant announcing that after 37 years of serving the community, Carnegie Hill Pediatrics would be closing its doors in November. Dr. Wendell was retiring, and Dr. Brown would be joining a new practice, Downtown Pediatrics. Given his new office's location near the Bowery, it wouldn't make sense for them to see him anymore. Laura knew Dr. Brown would understand this, but the thought of picking up the phone and telling him put a lump in her throat. "I'm afraid the location is a little inconvenient," she wrote. "You have been an important part of our lives, and it's hard to imagine someone filling your shoes. You have gone above and beyond. We wish you the very best of luck." After reading the letter over, Laura decided it wasn't enough. She would pick up the phone and call him. Not this afternoon, but tomorrow, or the next day. By the end of the week, she promised herself. In the meantime, she canceled Emma's back-to-school checkup. It didn't make sense to have her see two different doctors in the same school year. She called Margaret to ask for the number of Charlotte's pediatrician. Now that Emma was in second grade, Laura allowed herself the luxury of sleeping in until 8 on weekends. This meant that Emma, who rarely slept later than 7, was in charge of making her own cereal. "Get back in bed," Emma demanded one Sunday as Laura walked into the kitchen. She was standing in front of something she clearly didn't want Laura to see.
"Get back in bed?" Laura laughed. "But it's 8 o'clock.
"Get back in bed," Emma barked again.
Laura got back in bed. A moment later, her door was flung open.
"Breakfast in bed," Emma announced, bearing a tray with a bowl of oat bran.
"Breakfast in bed?" Laura affected a gasp of surprise. "What a treat!" Emma proceeded across the rug in ceremoniously staggered steps, moving her right foot forward, dragging her left foot up to meet it, and so on.
"Happy birthday," Emma said, passing her the tray.
"How sweet of you to remember," Laura said. "Thank you."
She had just picked up the spoon when Emma whisked the bowl away.
"Forgot the milk,"
she said, running out and returning a minute or two later.
"Mmm," Laura said after the first bite.
"Why are you sad?" Emma asked, scrutinizing her face.
"I'm not sad," Laura smiled, but Emma looked unconvinced, and her probing stare did not relent. Laura became aware of her breaths. She felt brittle and hollow. She wasn't sure why. She had always felt this way on birthdays, starting in her childhood.
"I made you a present."
Emma unzipped her fanny pack and procured a piece of clay in the shape of a ball.
"It's a paperweight. It's so your papers don't blow away."
"How useful," Laura said, cradling it in her palm.
It was still moist. She must have made it that morning.
"How thoughtful of you." It's supposed to look like a rock, Emma explained. Sorry, it's not very good.
It's beautiful, and that's exactly what it looks like, a rock.
The intensity of Emma's gaze was too much.
Okay, maybe I'm a little sad. Laura smiled through her tears. It's the happy kind, though.
You're not supposed to cry when someone gives you a present.
Emma grabbed the ball of clay from Laura's hand and threw it against the wall, where it stuck. Upon retrieving it, Laura discovered it had left a mark. After scrubbing the residue off, there was a faint discoloration, a subtle brown smudge. It was too low to hang a picture over it, but too high to hide behind her bureau. Like the liver spot on her left temple, she would have to get used to it. Then a solution came to her.
"That's it, dear?" Bibbs asked. "Are you sure that's all you want for your birthday? Wallpaper?"
Emma admired the elegantly dressed women of the Upper East Side. If only her mother would also wear lipstick, perfume, and high heels, she could at least carry a proper patent leather purse. That fall, a suit appeared in a store window they passed by on the way to and from school. In keeping with the fashion of the times, it consisted of a short skirt and matching blazer. If the mothers of Emma's classmates had a uniform, this was it. The first morning Emma pointed it out to her, Laura said, "We're late," and tugged Emma along, but when they passed by it on the way home that afternoon, Laura paused to have a closer look. After a suspenseful silence, she frowned and shook her head. On they walked. The suit remained in the window for several weeks, and each time they passed it, Emma's hope would be rekindled as Laura slowed down and registered the suit with a glance. On more than one occasion, Emma would grab her mother's hand and attempt to coerce her into buying.
It was so pretty. Please, please, pretty, pretty, please, would she at least try it on?
They were in the middle of one of these exchanges when Emma noticed someone inside the store, waving at them through the window. It was her mom's friend, Janet. They stepped in to say hello.
"Look at what Emma wants me to buy," Laura laughed, pointing at the suit in the window.
Janet did not laugh.
"Emma's right," she said. "You could use some grown-up clothes."
Emma pushed Laura into the dressing stall and asked the shopkeeper to bring over the suit in her mother's size. In a few minutes, Laura emerged from the stall, zipped and buttoned up. Emma held her breath as Janet and the shopkeeper gushed their approval. Watching Laura take out her credit card, Emma had the feeling that this was all a dream and she was about to wake up. And that's what it was like when they got home.
"I don't know what I was thinking," Laura said, reevaluating her purchase as she stood before the full-length mirror in their front hall closet. "I'm too small for short skirts and blazers. They made me look ridiculous. And the pattern reminds me of a carpet in a movie theater."
Emma was crushed. And so, the suit went directly from a Madison Avenue mannequin to one of the women at the homeless shelter. When Laura returned home from the shelter that Sunday, the babysitter was not doing her homework at the kitchen table as she usually did after putting Emma to bed. She wasn't in the living room either. Seeing the light was on in Emma's bedroom, Laura assumed they were still reading, but stepping inside, she saw the bed was still made. No sign of Emma or Daisy. Her own bedroom was dark. Both bathrooms were empty. Daisy always left her backpack and boots by the front door. The backpack was there, but the boots were not. A dizzying panic set in. Laura picked up the phone to dial Frank, in case he had seen them go out. Frank answered the phone after four rings. Yes, he had been in the lobby that evening. No, he had not seen Emma or a teenage girl leave the building. Laura retraced her steps through the apartment. What the hell had she been thinking, leaving Emma in the care of a teenager? Emma! She was the only thing in the world that mattered, to keep her safe, that was it. Without Emma, there would be no point to anything. She went back to the kitchen and dialed Margaret. Tripp answered. Margaret couldn't speak right now. She was tucking Charlotte in. There was a tap on the window. Laura was so startled she dropped the phone. It was Emma. She and Daisy were out on the terrace.
They were trying to tell her something. "Hold on, I can't hear you," Laura said, tugging on the door that led outside. It frequently got stuck. Daisy helped push it open.
"There was an eclipse," Emma's voice chimed with excitement. "It was so cool, Mom. The moon completely disappeared."
All across the city, holiday lights were going up. The flamboyant fire escapes of Harlem abruptly halted at 96th Street, where the demure twinkling of Carnegie Hill took over, eventually surrendering to the manic flash of Midtown. Then it was January, with its sobering return to routine and tree corpses on the curb. Laura still hadn't called Dr. Brown. The new year was a good excuse. But it didn't happen. Now it was February. Discovering Dr. Brown's home number had been disconnected, Laura phoned Downtown Pediatrics. "Dr. Brown is no longer affiliated with this practice," she was told. "Would you like to schedule an appointment with one of our other doctors?" "Where did he go?" There was a silence. "Would you like to schedule an appointment with one of our other doctors?" "No, we already have someone. I'm calling because I'm looking for Dr. Brown." "Dr. Brown is no longer affiliated with this practice. I'm sorry, ma'am, that's all I can tell you." Swallowing her pride, Laura called her mother to see if the two had been in touch recently. "No, and to tell you the truth, I'm a little irritated. I sent him a Williams-Sonoma gingerbread house for Christmas, and he didn't call to say thank you, which is very unlike him." "You've known him for barely a year. You don't know what he's like." "It's very unlike him," Bibbs repeated. There was a man who lived on the fourth floor of Margaret's building who hosted a supposedly famous daytime television show. Laura had never heard of the show, which bore his name, but after an encounter in the elevator with him, she was curious to watch it. It was like nothing she had ever seen. It featured emotionally unstable people confronting estranged family members or former lovers before a live audience. High-octane, profanity-riddled shouting matches ensued, with sordid revelations, accusations, and threats. Just as things felt on the verge of erupting into violence, a burly security person would lumber out onto the stage and there would be a commercial break. When the show resumed, the guests would be subdued, and the host would summarize the conflict before inviting members of the audience to offer their take on the situation. The audience had no shortage of opinions of these people and their problems, and the crueler these were, the rowdier the applause they generated. This was the part Laura could hardly bear to watch. Fortunately, most of the guests seemed incapable of seeing themselves for who they really were, and were thus indifferent to the audience's impression of them. It appeared the host of the show was blessed with the same deficit of self-awareness, Laura concluded, as she recalled the man she'd shared the elevator with, who'd been delighted to confirm his identity to a third passenger, one of the building's nannies, whose excitement bordered on hysteria.
"I am he,"
he'd said, the corners of his mustache rising in an unabashedly self-satisfied grin.
"Look, that's our apartment, right up there," Emma pointed as they waited to cross the light at 96th Street.
Emma's classmate Tiffany squinted as she looked up.
"I don't think my mom would like me to be in a neighborhood like this," she said.
"Why not?" Laura asked. The light turned. Laura took the girls' hands as they crossed. As they passed by James's corner, Emma waved and called his name, but James did not wave back. This had been the case recently. Laura was a little worried about him.
"Why do you know that guy?" Tiffany asked.
"James is our homeless man," Emma answered. "He calls me Goldilocks. Most of the time he's the friendliest person, but sometimes he's a little out to lunch."
As he often did, Frank had set up his easel in the lobby and was painting a picture of an angel. On the table where he'd put his supplies was an ashtray. It was so full that the cigarette butts protruded like the needles of a porcupine. The door to his apartment was ajar,
so the cats could wander in and out.
Who was that man? Tiffany asked when they were in the elevator.
That's our doorman, Emma said.
Why wasn't he wearing a uniform?
Frank is not a normal doorman.
Actually, Frank isn't a doorman, Laura spoke up. He's the super.
Then where was your doorman?
Tiffany addressed this question to Laura.
Not every building has a doorman, Laura said.
Hungry,
Emma announced, kicking off her shoes as they entered the apartment. Laura went into the kitchen and put some Oreos on a plate.
Not allowed to have those, Tiffany said when Laura called them in.
I am, Emma said, reaching across the table and stacking all four of them in her hand.
How about some wheat thins? Laura said, opening up the cupboard. Tiffany nodded glumly. Laura arranged some crackers on a plate and set it down in front of Tiffany. She went over to the fruit bowl and cut up an apple.
I don't care for apples, Tiffany said, when Laura set the plate on the table.
Me neither, Emma said, licking the inside of her Oreo. Hate 'em. Get 'em away from me before I barf.
Tiffany laughed as Emma pushed the plate toward Laura, who sat at the head of the table, which also functioned as her desk. It was not her job, but she'd agreed to stuff envelopes for the library's annual upcoming fundraiser. She mostly tuned out the girls' conversation until she heard Emma inform Tiffany, in a certain na-na-na tone, that her mother was 39 years old. Tiffany looked at Laura, expectantly, as though waiting for her to dispute this fact.
I'm coming up on 40, Laura told her. That's so much older than her mom, Emma beamed with triumph. Guess how old her mom is?
I have no idea, Laura said, trying to affect indifference, though she was a little curious.
25, Emma declared.
Really? Laura had to fight a smile as she looked at Tiffany, who confirmed the number with a defeated nod.
So she was quite young when she had you.
Tiffany shrugged.
You have an older sister, Laura said to Tiffany. How old is she?
11, Tiffany answered.
Soon, she'll be in upper school, and she'll have to wear a bra, Emma snickered.
Done with her Oreos, she got on her knees and reached across the table for a wheat thin.
You're supposed to ask first, Tiffany said, jealously pulling the plate toward her.
My house, my crackers.
Emma, Laura shook her head.
Fine, Emma said, clasping her hands together in a prayer pose and batting her eyelashes. She said in a mock English accent,
Pardon, madam, can I have a cracker? May I, Tiffany corrected her, passing her the plate.
Done with their snack, the girls disappeared into Emma's bedroom. Laura continued licking and stuffing. An hour passed.
Pardon? Said a little voice from behind her.
She turned to find Tiffany standing in the doorway to the kitchen.
Emma is not being very nice, and I would like to go home, please.
Laura tried to play diplomat, but neither party was interested in an apology or compromise. What each girl wanted was for Laura to vindicate her position and disavow the other. The conflict had arisen from the earlier exchange in the kitchen regarding the discrepancy in their mother's ages. Was it better to have an older mom or a younger mom was the crux of it. Emma insisted that Laura's seniority in years translated to superiority. Tiffany pointed out that having an older mom meant Laura would die sooner. That Laura found the whole thing quite amusing infuriated Emma.
Why are you laughing? She demanded. You think this is funny?
Unable to mend things, Laura proposed the girls play a game. Do an arts and crafts project. Get started on their homework.
Could we watch Hey Dude? Emma asked.
I love that show, Tiffany squealed with excitement.
At 5 o'clock, Tiffany's mother arrived to take her home. Mrs. Bavra was one of the tall, tall, rakishly thin specimens. Her face, Laura had to admit, was smooth as a teenager's, but she no doubt wore more makeup than an Olympic figure skater, and her hands had the telltale pronounced blue veins. Laura opened the door, but Mrs. Vavra did not step in. She lingered in the doorway, waiting for her daughter to get ready to leave.
"Is that real fur?" Emma asked, pointing to Mrs. Vavra's coat.
"Yes," she answered.
"But the animal died of old age," Tiffany added. "Oh," Emma nodded approvingly. "Well, then it's okay."
As Tiffany struggled with the many brass buttons that secured her coat, Laura bent down to assist.
"Emma's allowed to have Oreos after school," Tiffany announced as Laura crouched further to tie her shoes.
"Is she?" Mrs. Vavra responded.
"Guilty as charged." Laura looked up and smiled at Mrs. Vavra, who did not smile back.
"Also," Tiffany continued, "Emma gets to watch TV on school nights."
"Different households have different rules," Mrs. Vavra said. "Where's your headband?"
Tiffany reached up and patted her head.
"I think it's in my room," Emma said.
"Go help her find it," Laura told her. "Usually I don't allow TV during playdates," Laura explained as the girls ran off, but they had a little argument and it seemed like the best way to, Laura now struggled to convey the logic of it, to get them to drop it.
"I'm sorry to hear that," Mrs. Vavra said.
"It was actually quite funny," Laura told her. "It was about our ages." Mrs. Vavra looked puzzled. "I'm 39, and Tiffany told Emma you were 25. Laura paused, waiting for Mrs. Vavra to acknowledge the lie. Her refusal to do so emboldened Laura. "Emma was confused by the math," she continued, "and to be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure how to explain it to her." Mrs. Vavra raised her eyebrows. She looked like she wasn't planning to say anything. The girls returned. Laura held out Tiffany's backpack, but rather than take it, Tiffany turned around for Laura to mount it on her back. After slipping her arms through the straps, she nodded at her mom.
"Ready."
"What do you say?" Mrs. Vavra said, ringing for the elevator.
"Thank you," said Tiffany.
"Thanks for coming over, Tiffany. See you tomorrow," Laura said, shutting the door. When they were safely out of earshot, Emma asked,
"It is better to be 39 than 25, right?"
25 minus 11, Laura responded. Emma looked confused. "It's a math problem," Laura said. "You can do it. 25 minus 11.
14. No duh," Emma answered after a lengthy pause. "Is it better to be 39 or 25?
"There's a certain kind of woman who is terrified of getting older," Laura said. "I am not one of them." Emma looked unimpressed and frustrated by this answer.
"You never take my side," she said, and stomped off to her room.
"It's like a cocktail party at 8 a.m. without the cocktails," Tripp commented dismally.
Margaret shot him a look, but Laura agreed. Class parent breakfasts were tedious. As Margaret strolled off to circulate among the other, more social parents, Laura and Tripp were left on their own. Above the mantel hung a life-size oil portrait of the Vavra family, standing in front of the very same mantel, above which hung a slightly smaller oil portrait of the Vavra family, standing in front of the mantel, and so on, until they were tiny dots. Laura discreetly called it to Tripp's attention.
"That's crap," he said.
What most struck Laura about the Vavra's lavish Park Avenue duplex was that there was just one shelf of books, a line of leather-bound and gold-leaf British and Russian classics. Upon closer inspection, they'd clearly never been opened, but were part of a set intended for decor. Laura brought this up when she spoke to Margaret on the phone that evening.
"Are you surprised?" Margaret said with some irritation.
"They're not exactly intellectuals, Laura."
When Laura got off the phone, Emma looked up from her homework.
"Who are you talking about? Who cares they got no books?"
No one, Laura told her. And remember what I told you about listening to my private grown-up conversations?
But I don't get it, Emma persisted. Why does it matter they got no books?
Ignoring the question, Laura turned on the stove to get dinner started.
Who cares about books? Emma said, furiously erasing something in her workbook.
Satisfied, she blew the paper clean and wiped the remaining eraser debris with the sleeve of her turtleneck.
Some people don't care about books, Laura reflected, which is too bad, because books are a wonderful thing.
Noticing she had Emma's attention, Laura struggled to articulate the sentiment of what she was trying to say.
It's important to read.
I know, Emma said. Already read 3 books this week.
You're getting to be a much better reader, Laura told her.
After dinner, as Laura got started on the dishes, Emma reappeared in the kitchen to announce that she hadn't yet watched her allotted hour of TV and wasn't planning to.
That's fine, Laura said absently.
You know why, Mom?
Emma lingered in the doorway, hands folded across her chest. She waited until she had her mother's full concentration.
I want to read instead, because I like books more than TV.
Emma's tongue explored the interior of her cheek. She looked down, dragging her toe along a groove between the kitchen tiles.
The declaration caught Laura by surprise, and something in her went slack with tenderness. A dish slipped from the rubbery grip of her yellow gloves, sliding back into the soapy water of the sink. Margaret and Laura were invited to a private salon held at the apartment of Winthrop parents.
He's even more handsome in person, Catherine Poe, a fellow Winthrop alum and the host of the event, whispered as she took their coats.
The featured guest was an author who had recently published a best-selling novel, the kind of book everyone they knew was reading. Laura didn't need to read it to know it was trash. She could tell from the cover, 2 pairs of feet and rumpled bedsheets. The author himself looked like he'd just emerged from an afternoon in a hotel room, with his tousled hair, slap-happy grin, and dress shirt unbuttoned 1 loose button too many. Laura guessed he was 45 or 50.
As he read the first chapter, a handsome high school English teacher trapped in a stale marriage receives an anonymous love letter, Laura was reminded of someone, but she couldn't think of who, until Margaret leaned over to whisper, "He reminds me of Mr. Zinser."
Mr. Zinser, their 10th grade English teacher, an anomaly on the Winthrop faculty. He'd had sideburns, worn tight-fitting black turtlenecks, and often ended class by reciting his own poetry. Everyone professed to be in love with Mr. Zinser, and Laura spent class after class staring at him, trying to nurture the appropriate feelings. One afternoon, she was gathering her books to leave when Mr. Zinser asked her to stay behind. She assumed he wanted to discuss her marks. English had always been her strongest subject, but she'd been unfocused recently. But this wasn't the case. He wanted to talk about the way Laura looked at him in class.
"It's not the way a student is supposed to look at a teacher," were his exact words.
Laura's panic must have shown, because Mr. Zinser immediately followed this with a confession. He didn't think of her the way a teacher should think of a student, either. Laura didn't know what to say to this. He proposed they continue their conversation that evening, outside of school, and wrote down an address on a note card. Laura knew she should be flattered that this was validation of the highest order, but the prospect of meeting up with Mr. Zinser, alone and outside of school, gave her a stomach ache. She told her mother, in hopes that she might forbid her. But Bibbs got very excited, and insisted she wear lipstick and carry a comb in her pocketbook, as her hair sometimes looked limp. The address turned out to be Mr. Zinser's apartment. After taking Laura's coat, he pointed to a couch and told her to make herself comfortable, then disappeared into the kitchen. The couch was leather, and there wasn't any friction between its slick surface and the seat of Laura's skirt, and in the process of trying to make herself comfortable, she kept sliding around, like she was in the back of a taxi cab. Mr. Zinser returned with 2 glasses of white wine. He handed one to Laura and sat down beside her. After a moment of not saying anything,
Mr. Zinser reached out to tuck a strand of hair behind her ear and said, "Hi." Laura said hi back and took a long sip of wine. Mr. Zinser did the same. Then he leaned over and kissed Laura on the lips. And while this had been the thing she was dreading, now that it was happening, it was a relief, because she was no longer embarrassed or afraid. She wasn't anything. She felt nothing. After a few minutes of kissing, Mr. Zinser pulled back and asked if she wanted to go to his bedroom. Laura apologized and said, "No, thank you, she had to go home." To her relief, Mr. Zinser didn't protest, and he never asked her back again. The author was a teacher himself, a professor at Sarah Lawrence. He brought this up during the Q&A by way of explaining why it would be a few years before his next book came out.
"Sadly," he said with a roguish smile, "even a bestseller does not preclude one from needing a day job."
The room laughed, and a moment later he added, "And of course, I love teaching. I learn a lot from my students." When the questions ended, the waitstaff circulated among the guests with hors d'oeuvres. Catherine corralled Laura and Margaret into a conversation with the author, who was gushing about a novel that would be coming out next month, and which he predicted would be the next big thing, so much so that they might consider selecting it for their next salon.
"The author is very modest," he said, "so I better stop talking about it, as here she comes now."
A woman Laura had not noticed earlier insinuated herself into their circle. She couldn't have been more than 25 or 6, tops. Her hair was an artificial shade of red, and she wore too much eye makeup. In spite of this, she was strikingly beautiful. The author was quite taken with himself and emotionally immature. He didn't interest or impress Laura in the slightest. But this woman he was with, there was something unusual and fascinating about her. Her name was Elise, and she did not smile when he introduced her to the group, though she did repeat each person's name after it was told to her, with a self-possessed confidence that was vaguely masculine. Laura couldn't tell if she was British or simply spoke with an affect. Beneath her black form-fitting dress, she wore scuffed black boots. Men's boots, the kind a soldier would wear. When the author excused himself to get a drink, he looped his arm around Elise's lower back, taking her with him. Laura glanced at Margaret, but she was already exchanging a knowing look with Catherine. Laura's gaze drifted back to the couple as they made their way to the bar and focused on the author's arm, just below which the shifting contours of the woman's backside strained against its tight, silken container. In second grade, Emma still requested the occasional picture book for bedtime reading, but for the most part, they had graduated to chapter books. Laura was on the chapter in Little Women in which Jo meets a homely professor when Emma tapped her on the shoulder to deliver the following information. "In the olden days, it was against the law to get pregnant unless you got married first." "Was it?" Laura said, and went back to reading. A page later, Emma interrupted again.
"Are they going to do it?"
"Do what?" Laura asked.
"It," Emma sniggered.
"What is it?" Emma covered her mouth with her hand as she laughed again.
"S-E-X,"
she whispered. Laura rested the book on her lap. Dr. Brown's book had highlighted the anatomical function of certain body parts without explicitly spelling out the mechanics. They had yet to have the traditional facts of life conversation.
"Do you remember that book we used to read?" she asked. "A very special—" "I know this, Mom," Emma cut her off. "I'm in second grade."
"You know what?"
"What you're going to tell me."
Emma tugged at a loose thread on her quilt.
"A man sticks his ding-dong in a woman's vagina, a seed comes out, and that's how a woman gets pregnant."
"That's the conventional way to get pregnant," Laura said. "How most women do it. But there are some women—"
"No, duh, Mom," Emma interrupted. "You would never let a man stick his sausage in your vagina."
"Sausage?" Laura repeated. She'd never heard it called that before and hated to think where Emma had picked it up.
"I came from a seed you got from Sweden."
Emma spoke these words with casual indifference.
I'm Swedish. That's why I have blonde hair. No duh.
Where did you hear that? Laura asked. She was dumbfounded.
Emma's gaze briefly met Laura's, then returned to the loose thread, which she was coiling around the tip of her finger.
Bibbs, Laura said. Bibbs told you that.
Emma shrugged and puffed her cheeks out.
How old were you when she told you?
Another shrug.
I never told anyone, Emma said in a baby voice. She said it was a secret that you get mad at her if you knew she told me.
What else did Bibbs tell you? Laura asked, tucking a lock of hair behind Emma's ear.
That Swedish is the best country in the world to be from?
Emma looked at Laura, her forehead lined in worry.
Mama, please don't get mad at her.
Have you ever seen me get mad at Bibbs? Laura asked.
Emma thought for a moment and shook her head. That's because it doesn't do anything.
I know you love Bibbs very much, and she loves you very much, but she doesn't always think about how her behavior or decisions affect others.
Laura took Emma's hand in her own.
I'm so sorry she told you all this, darling, and then asked you to keep it a secret. How unfair of her. It must have been so confusing.
Nope, Emma shook her head. Ever since I got Kirsten?
She got out of bed and picked up one of her American Girl dolls. Part of the brand's appeal was that each doll represented a different era of American history and came with a unique backstory. Kirsten's family had emigrated from Sweden, hence her brass button cardigan sweater, 1995.
Ever since I got Kirsten, Emma continued, climbing back in, I always had this feeling I was Swedish.
After a few weeks of headaches and dizzy spells, Bibbs had gone in to see her doctor. Some tests were run, and the results were not good. She was scheduled to have surgery with the top neurosurgeon at Beth Israel the following morning. Douglas reported all of this to Laura over the phone. Where are you now? Laura asked.
We just got home, Douglas told her. She's upstairs, resting. Maybe you could stop by after work.
Laura stood up and put on her coat. Then she sat back down and dialed Nicholas.
I won't be able to leave the office until 4, he told her, but I just talked to Stephanie and she's on her way over.
Stephanie got there first. When Laura arrived, the baby was asleep in his stroller parked beside the umbrella stand. Nicholas Jr., not yet a year, was a large and indolent baby, much like Emma had been. Laura had yet to see him in the same outfit. Today, he wore a smocked one-piece with a Peter Pan collar embroidered with sailboats, a matching blue cardigan, white knee socks, and red sandals with brass buckles. As Laura gently removed a Cheerio stuck to his cheek, he stirred. Eyes barely open, he drowsily groped between his legs where there were more Cheerios. After securing one, he brought it up to his mouth. Nostrils flared, he chewed it slowly with his front teeth, the only ones he had. After swallowing, he reached for another, but his eyelids shuddered and his head went slack before he managed to retrieve it. Stephanie was sitting in the armchair beside her mother's bed, sipping a Diet Coke and giggling.
You think I'm kidding, Bibbs was saying. I'm not. One day, I looked in the mirror and I saw the beginnings of a beard and I thought, oh no, not this face. And so I covered my chin in cold cream and I picked up Douglas's razor and I...
Bibbs mimed the gesture. Spotting Laura, she smiled and patted the mattress.
I was just telling Stephanie that my biggest fear isn't death. It's what I'll look like should I become a vegetable. I'm entrusting you two with my skincare routine, which includes something I've never told anyone I do, but is part of the reason my skin is so smooth for a woman my age. She took Laura's hand and pressed it to her cheek.
It's very smooth, Laura said.
I'll tell you why, Bibbs said.
It's because once a week, I shave my face with your father's razor. He doesn't know.
It's on the shelf in the medicine cabinet, she said, pointing to the bathroom.
What do you think? Do you think you'd be able to do that for me?
Laura nodded. It wouldn't be a little weird for you, psychologically?